KALW.
Burning Man is an outgrowth of the Bohemian Grove, and it's actually a social experiment that's been taking place for 25 years now to control humans. Mm-hmm. Elon Musk, Mark Zuckerberg, both of the kids who run Google, they all go there. There's a reason for that. They kind of slipped a little bit when they let Grover like pop into the media. So if I disappear next week after your thing airs, you'll know why. Who the fuck knows?
Welcome to The Intersection at Burning Man. In this episode, we're going to separate fact from fiction as we explore the origins of the event with one of its founders. This episode's a little bit different than the others. I'm talking to just one person, and I'm not on the playa in a ladybug costume. Can you introduce yourself?
My name is John Law. I have a driver's license and a passport that say that. And I have to qualify this by saying that I'm talking about the period of time between 1990 and 1996, which is a seven-year period that I was involved in organizing the event on the Black Rock Desert, and a couple years prior to that on the beach.
1996. Burning Man turned 10. It was my first year on the playa, and his last. That's also the year that two people were run over in their tents, and another person, a good friend of John's, died in a head-on collision before the event began. We settle into John's cozy warren of an office on the top floor of the Tribune Tower in Oakland. Among other things, he's responsible for the upkeep of the landmark's iconic neon sign. Yes, we talk about 1996, but over the course of 2 hours, we cover a whole lot more. And what follows is an edited version of that conversation.
They turn the Melvins off.
Yeah.
All right. Hey.
Hi.
How you doing?
Good to really yeah. Good to meet you.
Likewise. KLW, are we doing good work?
Yeah.
You know, let's get you comfortable. I can put, there's a chair.
Okay.
Right here. It'll be a little cramped.
It's okay. Do you don't mind?
Yeah.
You don't mind, I don't mind.
So
hey. I'm going to start with a story.
Oh, very good.
So for me, the story starts in 96. Because I went out there, had no idea what I was going to.
Yeah, that's the best.
The whole experience felt like, oh, this is what it is. I didn't know anything that was going on.
And I think by then it was doubling in size every year. And I knew we were headed for a disaster. There's no way around it. I mean, I knew there were going to be 10,000 people there that year. 95 was real close. I mean, you know, there were a couple of minor injuries. Nobody got killed. But it was obvious. And we had to get a bigger, we had to be more controlling. We had to have more cops, more accountants, more this, more that. And we didn't. You know, we had very little money and very little resources. And honestly, some people involved in organizing the event weren't that worried about that, you know. And other people, you know, just wanted to build it in any way, shape, or form. There are a couple other people involved, Larry primarily, who wanted to grow the event regardless. I mean, no matter what. Grow.
He's talking about co-founder Larry Harvey, who's the person most associated with Burning Man.
Kept saying, like, we shouldn't be advertising it. We should be like, not to keep people from coming, just to keep let it grow more organically.
Back in 96, there were no addresses, no alphabet of streets in concentric circles around the man. There was just a center camp where, like now, you couldn't buy much more than coffee and ice.
The camp layout at that point in time was center camp, and we had a kind of a parachute kind of thing. And then there was a V coming out from that point, and then a direct line to where the man was standing. So there was a rudimentary layout, but it was a geometric layout, which actually I thought it should have been much more organic. Have like big camps here, small camps there, and they just set up wherever they want. And let it be a completely random so that you couldn't find anything. And so people would literally wander randomly and stumble into things as though magic and then maybe never see them again and not have any idea where they were. And I was outvoted on that. I realized even at the time I suggested that it wasn't that practical. It was just less controlling. You know, I find control boring. So there was that schism between freedom, anarchy, and control. And control won out because it just does.
To say he found control boring is an understatement. Before Burning Man, John spent more than a decade at the center of the Bay Area's underground anarchist culture.
You know, I don't feel particularly exceptional. I feel like I fell down a rabbit hole in 1976, and I just feel like I was lucky in the right place, right time, with a bad attitude. Because when I came here at 17 in 1976 looking for the party, and all the toothless hippie drug addicts told me the party was over, and I just went on and did what I was doing and met all these other people, we made our own fucking party.
That fucking party began with the Suicide Club, a secret society that was one of the first extreme urban exploration groups.
Going in a sewer is pretty cool, you know, to me. Climbing a bridge is pretty cool. For the first year of the Suicide Club, we'd go in a sewer, we'd climb a Golden Gate Bridge, we'd go sledding down the letters of South San Francisco, we'd do something really weird, and then like at 2 in the morning or at dawn, we'd pick up our lunch pails and go, okay, see you next time, pal.
The party continued with the Cacophony Society, another underground social group that made an art of transgression and trespassing. But this one was a little less secret.
So there were a bunch of articles about Cacophony. What would happen is, like, we'd have an article in the Examiner or the Chronicle or something, and 10 or 20 new people would show up at our monthly meeting, like at Edinburgh Castle or Tommy's Joint or something. Then they'd come on some event, and like out of those 10 people, like 9 of them would go running away in abject horror. That was kind of how you separate the wheat from the chaff or whatever.
Both Cacophony and Suicide Club were progenitors of Burning Man and part of the rich, underground, countercultural history of the Bay Area.
What I'm hoping to get at is the philosophical underpinnings of it.
Well, the philosophical underpinnings of Burning Man, the beach event was basically a bonfire with a bunch of people drinking beer. First on the desert, there were 70 people. I knew 60 of them. And so it's this weird thing. Like, people think it was some, like, magical, mystical, amazing. I mean, it was cool, but we didn't have much infrastructure, and we knew that it was a place where we could, was total freedom, we could do whatever we wanted to, and that was important.
I mean, was there even anything called a center camp? No.
Yeah, of course, from the get-go. I don't know what you've heard about this, but it was planned. But yeah, I mean, we went out, we picked a point in the desert, set it up, we tried to set up a center camp, and the man was standing over from, you know, like, probably 200 yards from there. And we did our Cacophony Society formal dress cocktail party, which was something we did in sewers and in junkyards. And it was just a thing that we did. And so we'll do it on the desert. It was not an elaborate thing. That sort of thing came later. The philosophy or underpinnings of the event came from a longstanding, very involved and engaged San Francisco underground history going back decades. Okay, we're influenced by the Suicide Club and Cacophony Society came out of a group called Communiversity, which was a free university movement in the 60s. And Communiversity was the whole idea was free. You'd exchange goods, ideas, classes, information for free. So it's a radical idea in a commodified culture. It's still a radical idea. And the initial culture that Burning Man came out of came from that directly. Later, there were a couple things that were quite important. Kerry Galbraith, who was one of the main organizers in Cacophony, came up with the concept of the Zone Trip. The idea was that the Zone was a place you'd go, and anything could happen. You'd go there and be enlightened, you could go there and maybe die. So that was kind of the idea of her. Then we ran into the philosophy of Joaquin Bay, who's an East Coast philosopher who wrote about a thing called the Temporary Autonomous Zone, concurrently and, you know, synchronistically. When we did the first Zone Trip, which was to L.A. in 88, we drove down, it was 3 o'clock in the morning, we stopped at a random spot that she just felt embodied the entryway to the zone. We stopped, drew a line in the dirt, and stepped across it into the zone. And the concept, which we dove right into, was that we were entering a mental, psychic, metaphysical, pataphysical space where anything could happen. We were just going to L.A., right? L.A.'s a weird enough place, but if you put that into your brain, it's like you're in an alien universe. The next 2.5-3 days were just like that. All of us were in an altered state of mind, and not just drugs, because I think we did, you know, probably smoked a little weed or something, but we would randomly go to places that people would pick, just randomly. And I'd always want to go to the Hollywood Letters, you know, let's go to the Hollywood Letters. We just drove there and climbed them. So we were open to anything. We didn't have an agenda. We didn't have, like, here's our itinerary, this is what we're going to do. We did not have that. It was like, and it was one of the most amazing things I've ever done. It was just Los Angeles, right? So Burning Man on the Desert was the fourth zone trip. It's called, we called it Bad Day at Black Rock, Cacophony Society Zone Trip number 4.
It's tempting to make a neat timeline of Burning Man's history, but the reality is messier and reflects a lot of collaboration.
There were a dozen women involved in the early days of Burning Man, half of whom have never been heard of, and they did major crucial things. There's no one guy who went out and threw his rib on the desert and there's Burning Man. Okay, I didn't do that. Nobody else did that either, trust me.
What became Burning Man started as a bonfire on Baker Beach, where Larry Harvey and some friends drank beer and burned a wooden effigy of a man, a stick figure, really. That became a summer solstice tradition. The term Burning Man didn't exist until 1988. And technically, that first year in the desert in 1990, that was not an event called Burning Man either. Cacophony Society had invited Larry Harvey to burn his wooden effigy at their Zone Trip event. That's after the cops stopped him from torching it on Baker Beach. And that's how Burning Man and the rest of us ended up at the Black Rock Desert.
We drove out 100 feet on the playa, drew a line in the dirt, stepped over it, then got into our vehicles. There were about 30 people, and we drove out randomly to a point out in the middle of nowhere. That was the first year. The second year through the seventh year, I would pick the location where the camp was going to be. I always tried to put the camp as close to the convergence of the three counties as possible, Pershing County, Washoe County, and Humboldt County, to make it unclear whose jurisdiction it was. Doing illicit events, or events that you're not supposed to do, not sanctioned, you know, you're taking a huge risk, okay? You have to be super responsible to do it properly, and leave no trace. The idea came from the suicide club. Go into an abandoned space, go into a live urban infrastructure site, go where into the desert, go wherever you go, and take everything back with you. Don't leave anything. Don't let anybody know you were there. The reason for that wasn't just environmental. It was spiritual. You're using these spaces and visiting them, but the idea was not to trash them, not to destroy them, not to let, no, look, here I am. Look at me, my selfie, here I am. And there aren't a lot of recordings of the suicide club because we had this philosophy. The idea was that you're living in it. Where if you were recording something, you weren't really part of the action, you weren't really part of the event.
What do you think brought this group of people together in the get-go? What were you, you know, how did you find each other?
Which group of people at what time? Well, you're talking about?
Let's say Burning Man on the Desert.
Burning Man on the Desert was the first year, 1990, was, you know, 60%, 70% cacophony people who were already doing events and knew each other. There was a community already. There were a handful of carpenters that worked with Jerry James on the building the Burning Man structure, and I think some of them, a couple of them came out. But aside from that, and there were some locals from the Gerlach area who they came out. They thought, here we blow through town like at dawn, you know, in a little caravan of like 20 cars, stop at Bruno's for breakfast, and word gets out on the street in Gerlach that San Francisco hippie Satanists are going out to do, you know, like Satan rituals out on the desert. We heard about this later from people that we became quite friendly with in town, right? It was a story for years. And so they come out to check us out, and who knows what, and they realize that we're armed, because we're doing, that was another thing, we were doing a lot of shooting events at that time. That was a very common thing. And the locals were like, oh, they thought, oh, there's these hippie Satanists out there, and they came out and looked at us and go, oh yeah, they're all like kind of weirdos and fags and hippies, and but they have guns. So maybe they're okay. And I'm not even making that up. So they cut us some slack, did not shut the event down, in part because we had one of the implements and symbols of part of their culture. Hence, we had a, you know, like a crossover there. And that gave us some slack to be able to continue doing the event.
So I guess what I'm curious about is, whether it's Cacophony Side or whatever, what is bringing that group of hippie Satanists, what do they share? What's gluing you guys together?
Well, the important thing about Cacophony, and this is changed now. Burning Man's a very different event, you know, so we're not talking about Burning Man now. I'm talking about the period between 90 and 97. With that said, the thing that brought people in Cacophony together was the fact that your average Cacophony individual wasn't necessarily an exceptional person in obvious respects at all. They weren't, you know, like ninja climbers or, you know, like actors or super hyper witty, you know, like Oscar Wilde types. There were a couple that kind of approached that. But for the most part, they're kind of average people who want to create an interesting life, but without destroying their day-to-day, without leaving reality, let's say, or the default world that you have to live in to make a living. And so we'd go out on weekends at nights and do these crazy events. And so the average person in Cacophony is not a joiner. They found a group that they could join full of other non-joiners where they didn't have to do anything to conform. And before the internet, if you found Elena Fronte, who was one of the major organizers of the Suicide Club, earliest iteration, was in the 70s, and you know, she said, yeah, you can find a guy in any bar in town, but finding a real weirdo is difficult, really difficult, because there was no online forum. You know, if you're interested in transmichelian swallows and their flight patterns, right, you're never going to find another person who's interested in that. With the internet, you'll find 100 of them, almost guaranteed, or maybe 50 of them, okay? But in 1977, you couldn't. There was no way to connect with people. So when you ran into a person who was really had that odd, who wanted to do odd stuff, who was willing to take these risks, who saw the world saw the environment as a playground, that was a special thing. You found a special person. These are people who didn't care, you know, they didn't care to look stupid. You could go out and do in a stupid costume and you didn't really care, you know, because you're protected by your instant community of non-community type people. I don't know how else to put it. Cacophony was not cool. It wasn't a hip thing. And the Suicide Club definitely wasn't. The people who were cool and hip, they thought we were nuts. You know, because I remember I worked at the York Theater selling popcorn in 79 and 80. Not bad people. I mean, I liked them. But a lot of the hipster kids who were skinny tie new wave kids, you know, were working there. And we'd be talking about going in the sewers, and they had just gone to see the Talking Heads or something, right? They'd pat us on the head like we were, you know, like developmentally disabled. And they didn't think we were cool at all. And we were fine with that because we weren't doing it to be cool. We're doing it because it was fucking exciting and fun. I mean, it's all like transgressive, you know, social action with a group of people that makes it safer. Burning Man is very conformist in a lot of respects. You have to, you know, I mean, it's pretty broad ranging, okay, and I want to criticize it. It's still a great event, but it's quite different. You know, there are all these little social things that you have to kind of fit into in order to not be rejected. I mean, in some instances. We had some Republicans in Cacophony, and they weren't rejected, let's put it that way.
But so for you, though, when did it switch from being a zone trip to not?
Well, zone trip probably was subsumed by a larger growing culture. When Desert Sightworks came in, that had a huge influence on the culture of the event. And he's been left out of the history. And
who?
William Benson. Very important, really important character, and brought a lot to that event.
On the Burning Man website, William Benson is referred to as the event's visual thought leader. And he's credited with bringing that Mad Max on acid aesthetic to the Playa with his Desert Sightworks event beginning in 1992.
And his idea was to create a literal living art installation where people were part of the art, where they're creating art, building things, set pieces to be in and be part of, and interacting in a ritual sense around it. And on top of that, making the guy a true visionary, he's a major, extremely talented, large format photographer, and he wanted to take these giant photographs, one-off photographs, of these huge, you know, landscape tableaus with people and artworks in them.
These long, ghostly exposures are filled with people in elaborate, earthy costumes, cavorting in and around primitive structures and sculptures. Here and there are pops and traces of neon, supplied by John.
In 93, he partnered with Judy West, who was an art administrator, and she had a space in Project Artaud. And they ended up inviting some artists from Artaud and then went to open studios and artists that they liked and thought could do something, and they invited them to come out. It was the first time there was a decided, planned out collection of actual artists, because Cacophony Society had some artists in it, but we never self-identified as an art group. There were a couple of artists there before, don't get me wrong, but Serious Art came in and with the Desert Sightworks, and that had a huge influence on the culture of the event. That and the Space Cowgirls, who came around that time, the radio, the people doing the radio station had a big influence on it. And so they brought in a lot more cultural touchstones and a lot more various influences. And so that's when it started becoming more than just a Cacophony Society event, probably 93.
Concurrently, something else was emerging that ultimately changed Burning Man and, well, civilization as we know it. It's called the World Wide Web.
By that time, Burning Man and other Cacophony events and other stuff in general was starting to break out and to become cultural memes, which we didn't understand at the time, because of our proximity to the rise of the internet culture right here in the Bay Area. And by the time that stuff busted out, it just happened to be that we were the people next to the Silicon Valley doing all these weird events, Burning Man being the, you know, the 800-pound gorilla in the room, and it blew up because of that, like really blew up because of that. And in particular, Burning Man became the sanctioned corporate vacation for Silicon Valley over time, because it started out with the real interesting folks who were really exploring culture, who would go to, you know, to this early iteration Burning Man and really trip out, oh my God, like you, I mean, trip out on it, like this is great. And then invite all their friends who were in tech, and then the corporations realize, oh wow, this is really valuable. And like all throughout history, you know, it's very important for control to have a sanctioned vacation that all their workers can go to and get naked, paint themselves blue, drop acid, fuck somebody they just met for a week, and then go back to work in their cubicle for the rest of the year.
Between 1993 and 96, the population of Black Rock City grew from 1,000 to 8,000.
And Burning Man, as it got bigger, control was absolutely mandatory because more people came, and you have to control things simply to be responsible, or people get hurt. And I'm extremely aware of that. And we did everything that we could to make the event safe, but psychically inside myself, I was all, every time we had to ban something, a little part of me died. And we had to start banning certain things by 95, 96. And as soon as we had to start doing that, I was like not liking it as much anymore. You know, that sense of absolute personal freedom. And I don't mean being irresponsible. Real anarchists who want real anarchy are aware of other people and they're aware of the boundaries, and you know, but they want to do everything that they can to be free, simply free from conformity and simply free from hierarchies. But of course, if you get together in any group of people, hierarchies start forming. That's how it goes. You know, you have conformity when something becomes a big cultural movement. You have to look a certain way or be a certain way to some degree, or you're rejected. But with that said, if you hadn't been to the event, you should probably go, you know, check it out at least once. You know, some people are mortified by it. Some people, it changes their lives for the better. You know, there's a whole range. Clearly, each year is amazing in its own respect. Okay, I know I haven't been there in a long time, but I know that from people that I know that still go. And even 96, which is a disaster in many respects, it was astonishing what happened there that year. It was really off the hook. And even at the time it was happening, even at the time I was going from one accident site to another, you know, to the most horrible one where a friend of mine was decapitated. Okay, even with all that going on, you could look at the larger event and realize that people were, you know, digging it. It was a pretty amazing thing. You know, I'm not against it. I think it's a great event, but it's not what it was, and that's fine. It's totally fine.
After the 1996 debacle, the Bureau of Land Management seemed disinclined to renew the event's permit, which takes place on federal land in Nevada. So it was relocated to private land for a year, and they added in roads and assorted rules to make the event safer. As lore has it, co-founder Larry Harvey and others within Burning Man were willing to accept the establishment of rules and some order if it allowed the event to keep going and growing. It was just too much of a trade-off for John.
Oh, I couldn't go on with it. As it became more and more controlled, the last thing I wanted to be was a cop or an accountant. That's the direction it was going in, for sure. And into more control. I mean, you can't burn fires, you can't do, I mean, I don't know, I mean, I haven't been in a million years, but you can't do all kinds of shit. You know, that would drive me insane. I would naturally completely break all the rules, and I would encourage everybody else to do that. Frankly. And to me, the interesting thing and the amazing thing about the first year in the desert, which if you looked at it, didn't look that exciting. It was kind of cool. Here's some people in the desert burning some stuff. They got a figure of a man. That's kind of cool. The thing about it was stepping over that line into this mental state of being completely free. That's what it was. And that's what made it magic. So stepping out of the control and temporarily being free is the best you're going to get. So a format was created that's been very successful, where you have small spots, you know, and the ability for people to freak out and be free in a certain sense, but not really. But they're selling that idea of freedom, and it's a great fucking product, fucking awesome product. I mean, they generate $60 million in receipts.
Is there anything about what it's become that surprises?
Burning Man's part of a larger cultural shift. I mean, it's Burning Man's a corporation, okay? It's not a cultural movement, it's a corporation.
Technically, Burning Man has been a nonprofit since 2014. Prior to that, it was owned by BlackRock City LLC, which still exists, but it's been subsumed by the nonprofit. And while the financials for this year's burn haven't been released yet, the event took in more than $43 million in revenue in 2017.
It's part of a larger cultural shift, you bet, but that's where control comes in. You can't control a cultural movement. It's not controllable. The civil rights movement was not controllable, okay? Everybody was involved in that. I mean, organizations, individuals, educators, you know, businesses, they all, because there's a moral imperative at play there that had to be addressed. It took a long time. But that was a real movement. You know, Burning Man, is it a real movement? I don't know. I mean, I'm not sure of that. I mean, it may be just a big party, you know, for rich people. You know, that may be what it is, but I don't know. We'll see. I think the jury's still out on that.
That said, there is one thing he is sure of.
Burning Man is not the entire counterculture, okay? That's a misnomer. And speaking as one of the founders of the Burning Man Festival, I find it annoying that anybody thinks that Burning Man is the entire culture, because it's not. It's part of a larger cultural shift, okay? And it's hubris to say differently. This whole, like, giant philosophical, heavy-duty Burning Man, this, that's just a bunch of malarkey, frankly. You know, I'm sorry, it just doesn't, you know, it's very simple. We started making jokes by about 93. We started making jokes about turning it into a religion, and it was a joke, okay? It was a joke.
I mentioned the 10 principles, the core values that guide Burning Man's culture, but John doesn't bite.
I'm not going to go there. Sorry. No, I don't want to get into that. The burning bush. That's all I have to say about that.
Thank you.
Okay. I have nothing to hide. My heart's right on my sleeve. I don't give a fuck.
Thanks for listening. On the next episode of The Intersection, we'll meet a group of burners whose mere presence at the event may surprise you.
It confuses other people. They're like, what do you mean a blind person is going to Burning Man? What are you doing here? Why? How can you understand this?
Listen to new episodes every other Wednesday. Subscribe to The Intersection podcast wherever you get your audio fix.
We call this a scene.
What's that?
This, you know, like, so it's not just you talking the whole time. There's like, he's turning the lock.
Oh, right.
If you like what you hear, leave us a review. And if you want to know more about the podcast, head to theintersection.fm. The Intersection is a co-production of David Boyer and KALW. Jonathan Davis is the associate producer. It's edited by Ben Trefney and engineered for your listening pleasure by Gabe Graben, with theme music from Eric Pearson. Until next time, I'm David Boyer, and this is The Intersection.